Hello, this is the PC Gamer Show. I am Wes Fenland, features editor, and I'm doing another GDC special episode. We've got a bunch of folks in town for GDC 2018, and I'm joined by Sven Vink of Larian to talk about Divinity, Divinity 2. How's it going, Sven?
It's going very well, thank you.
Yeah. As you probably noticed, Divinity was a game that we liked a little bit at PC Gamer. Ended up being our game of the year last year, actually. And I wanted to catch up with you about kind of everything that's been going on at Larian since you released the game. Was that October, September? I don't even remember when the final release was.
September 14th was the release date. And so, afterwards we relaxed a little bit because we worked quite hard to finish it. And then, I guess, starting November, we started working on our next thing.
Wow, okay. I mean, that's pretty quick turnaround. You had a little downtime. And I know you put out a bunch of patches, like post-release stuff for the game. Is that still ongoing at all, or are there still pieces you're kind of adding here and there?
Yeah, I think there's another patch in production. I don't know exactly when it releases, but... it's a big game, you know. There's really a lot of content in there. And so as we progress and we discover things, we fix them. I mean, the list is getting smaller because, like, I think most of the big things are all gone. Mm. I don't think there's, like, really, really big things left. So it's everything that made it to the C list or the D list. So but we keep on going on.
I ran into a decent number of bugs while playing, but it's the kind of game where, thankfully, most of the bugs just end up being kind of entertaining, or you know, they don't really ruin the experience, right? Yeah. Like, we had one that I don't even know if it was a bug, but you know, I played the whole game co-op, and we the dwarf's quest, on beast's quest, towards the end, you have kind of a showdown with your cousin, who is the queen, and at the end of it, she survived, and kind of they had their moment of closure, and then she turns around and walks out of the room into death fog and just immediately dies.
No, she's not supposed to do that. I actually think that is fixed already.
So it was one where we were like,
"Fog is yeah."
But it didn't really wreck anything. It's like, well, we got our experience. I guess her story has ended abruptly, but you know, otherwise
she
it was
supposed
fun.
To go somewhere.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, how the response to the game, like, you know, we were far from the only ones who really, really enjoyed it. You know, how that played for you in the studio and sort of your feeling the past few months after releasing it.
Yeah, it was, so we had a very intense development. We made a lot of changes even up to the very last day in our typical style, I guess. And then when we released, I mean, we had a feeling it was good, but we didn't realize it was going to be appreciated as much as it was. I think the biggest indicator of how much people like it is the median time that people are playing it. So it keeps on selling well, and the median time keeps on going up, which basically means people keep on playing it even if there's a larger pool coming in. And so it's now at 40 hours, which is really high.
Wow, yeah. So that means that the median of everybody who's bought that game is playing a pretty long time. I feel like the median for the average game on Steam would be much, much lower than that.
Yeah, so if you take Original Sin 1, it was 10 hours.
Wow, okay.
All right, so this is it's four times as much.
People who got stuck in Cyseal.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit more unforgiving, but there's a lot of content, of course, in those two. So I don't have stats on exactly where they are, but it's good to see that people are playing it as much as they do. And the other thing that has been really rewarding is the stories that came out. I mean, like, you would dead fuck, yeah, well, all right, it happens, right? it's a game that's meant to be glitched and abused and still tries to entertain you, you know, a little bit like you would have a pen and paper RPG, and so it's doing that, so it's cool.
What are some of the best glitches and abuses you've seen, you know, from Twitch streamers or from just people, you know, tweeting at you guys or posting on forums?
Oh, there's a... Well, obviously, there's the mass murderers that are unleashed, and
just ruin. Kill everyone in the world.
No, it's about you always have, like, you have typical different types of players that play together, and then it's absolute chaos because one guy is trying to do the quest, the other guy is like ruin everything that you're doing on the quest. So you have many of those stories going on. But then you also see people that really come up with the craziest combos, and so they are. Teleporting trolls into lava is like that was one that was intended, but you see the reaction when they discover it. And say, oh my god, I can do that! Like, you know, it's a big fight, and you just can just whoop, there, goodbye. And so it's that kind of thing. The way when the game is too hard, they start figuring out ways of going around it. It's really nice to see.
In the first game, I remember, I think, like, the speed running strategy for, like, Awesome Games Done Quick or something was collecting a bunch of barrels, right, and then using the extreme weight of a ton of items to just, like, instantly crush an enemy. Okay. Are there some strats like that that have come out for Divinity 2?
In terms of min-max strategies, the thing is that we've been patching away a lot of things, right? So I remember one of the funniest ones I've seen was the stacking chairs strategy, so that you get a height advantage.
Mm.
So then, you know, because when you put the chairs on top of each other and you clicked on the top chair, you sat on top, but essentially you were at a height advantage. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was cool to see, right? So it's... I guess probably the most dominant one is people kiting, putting items to obstruct the AI, although it's pretty good already, the AI now. So, but the real dominant strategy, I haven't really seen one.
Mm. Yeah. So going back to GDC, I think 4 years ago, you gave a talk after the release of Original Sin 1, three mm-hmm. or 4 years ago. And I think that was even before I'd met you, but I went to that talk and you went through basically all the crazy things you had to do to survive as a studio to make the game you wanted to make. You had to take out loans and you know, you were really on the ragged edge. And if that game had flopped, it
kind of,
you would have been dead. But it didn't flop. You got to make Original Sin 2. You had a successful Kickstarter. Was the development of Original Sin 2 a little more relaxed than the first one, or you know, were you still kind of also on the edge while making that game, or do you have a little more wiggle room?
We had more wiggle room, but we did go. I mean, it was a much broader game, a much much bigger team working on it also. I think that there was a lot of pressure on us also because DOS 1 was well received. So there was a lot of stuff that people wanted to see improved, and so it's always hard because you don't know if you're going to manage to improve it. So it puts a lot of pressure on your shoulders. So I think it was more that type of pressure that we felt to still give people what they wanted, but still bring new stuff to it. So it worked out well. So that was cool to see. And then it was just also sheerly the sheer insanity of the game when you start thinking about all the branching trees that are in there and how the origin stories, all the different perspectives of play that you can have on a singular quest. I don't think that there was anybody at the end that still knew everything about what was
you could
going.
Only know the piece of the game that you'd sort of been following at that point.
Yeah, well, I like to think that I knew most of it, but it was just, there were so many permutations of every single situation, and QA was having a field day, and we kept on changing things continuously because we saw that's not working. If you do this and this and this and this, that story is going to suck. So let's, and at the same time we were recording the voices, right? So we had states where, like, Sybil, her big moments in the middle of the game, Gigi, the lead writer, he was writing in the morning the script, which was being recorded in the afternoon.
Wow.
As it was being put into the game, and all that, like, in the last months of release. So we had a crazy time, but it was really cool. I mean, it was really, really cool to see how people then picked it up.
So it sounds like the pressure was a bit more, you know, coming from yourself and from fan expectations than it was like a bank breathing down your neck, like, we're going to destroy you.
Yeah, so we didn't have that because DOS 1 kept on selling well. Mm-hmm. So it's been, I think it's been since release, DOS 1 has been in the top 100. Not anymore because DOS 2 has kicked it out now. But I mean, back up to that moment, it really sold well. And we had the early access also. DOS 2 had a very successful early access also. Pretty much a little bit, well, more successful than DOS 1. So for us, that model works really well.
How, I know a lot of things changed during development, but what were kind of the biggest factors that from the early access release, the feedback you got, you know, on the game that changed its course up to the final release?
Oh, there's always a bunch of things, right? So first of all, when you talk about RPG systems, discussions will be forever. so we changed a number of things, like we kicked out durability. That was a big one. We figured out that there were a number of things that were unclear to players, so we worked on polishing that. A lot of stuff that happened in tutorial, which I think we could still have done better, but... So it was, I think, the most important bits were on the systems and then the things that weren't clear in the UI that we were doing. And then the other thing that we got out of early access was balancing information because we were measuring the analytics of how people were playing. So that helped a lot in setting up the pacing of the beginning of the game, hard but not too hard. Yeah, we had tons of feedback of people like, well, this is not working if you do this and this and this, and it's, oh, I never even thought of this, right? So those kind of things. So it led to a more polished game, even if you had bugs. But I mean, yeah, I don't think anybody that releases an RPG will ever manage to get you a bug-free experience. Mm-hmm. If you want these type of games, there's just too many permutations of the possibilities that are in there.
Most players know it's kind of the trade-off they're making is, you know, okay, I'm going to have a million choices and, you know, 100 of them are going to have bugs at the end, you know, something like that.
That's the nature of software, right?
So with the final game, what are sort of the two, give me like two either, you know, quest lines or little moments that, you know, you're really, really proud of that you especially loved. And then on the flip side, two things that either didn't make it into the game that you wanted or that you kind of wish you'd been able to do more with.
All right. So one of my favorite moments is, Lose finding the plane of the demon that has been chasing her the entire time. It's late in the game. But it's a really nice moment because it's unexpected also, what you see.
Losa was my character, I'm right there with you on that one.
So that was fun. On the situations that what did I not like? I know that we, in Act 3, there's a bunch of stuff that we could have done better. Let's pick Kem, for instance, the way that he... I'm spoiling it for people who haven't played.
I think at this point, you know, you can pause if you don't want to hear some Act 3 stuff. Yeah. But
so we had this this villain in Act 3 called Kem, and he was not very present. And so he should have been much more present. He should have had introduced himself and like say, hey, and then do his villain appearances so that you actually, that you, because now you had no feeling for him whatsoever. So we could have done that better. The other thing I also think, that's the quest, right? You asked me about the quest.
Like anything else, you know, that you wish had gotten into the game or, you know, kind of, ideas that you might hold on to for a sequel.
I will tell you something. Originally, it was much bigger. It was planned that you would be able to visit the ancient empire. You would go to the elven lands. So all of that, we all cut it out because
it's not exactly a small game as it is.
You would be surprised. We actually thought it was going to be too short.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we always make the same mistake. It's incredible. But there's this huge problem at Larian is that once we look at a screen and say there's nothing to do here, right? So we keep on filling it up, and the games become incredibly dense. But as a result, when you're playing it, like, because everybody wants to figure out everything because they think we need to do everything, right? And so the pace of play becomes so slow, because people are exploring, they're enjoying themselves, right? So that our worlds are just too big, and so we have to condense them, we have to cut them, and so forth. So, and every single time we fall in the same trap. And this time, really, because I remember meeting, like, guys, it's not going to be big enough, we need to make it bigger.
Maybe you need to hire one person on the staff who just always thinks the game should be smaller to balance out.
Oh, there's guys. Yeah. There's definitely guys that this is going to sound incredibly unprofessional, but... it's a true story, and it happened, and it was a good thing. There's this second map when you go in Driftwood, and it's a fairly large map, right? And it's so large because we all thought it was smaller. the artist who was responsible for the level design of it, he made a small mistake, and we had these meetings. And are you sure that it is the size of Cyceel? Because it was supposed to be a Cyceel size map from DOS 1. Are you sure it's a size? Yeah, I'm sure. So, man, why are we having such a hard time putting all this content in there? Right? I'm sure. And then eventually, of course, he discovered that it was 9 times as large. And so we were like, oh, God, what have you done? But we were already busy. So I said, oh, well, you know what, we'll just fill it up. But we spent much, much more time on that map than we expected. And that was it was a good thing because you had a lot of freedom going all over the place on that map. There were really many, many ways of finishing it also, including one where you can actually just rush through it and just go off to the Council of Seven whenever you wanted.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting challenges for me playing with co-op friends is, like, how much are we agreeing or disagreeing on how much we want to play of the game? You know, like, do we want to do every single quest that we can find? Do we want to go just scouring the map together? Because that will take longer than if we split up and do stuff. So it's interesting that as a result, there were a couple quests, I think, where, you know, one person did the whole quest and the rest of us didn't even see it. But we knew it was there. We were all busy doing something. Somebody was off, you know, rebalancing their character while somebody else is doing a quest. But it's just whatever you find.
Yeah, and that's
the most fun.
That's one of the things I really like about it, the ability to split your party and go everywhere you want and then affect it and then come back again. It's one of the really unique things about those two.
So after finishing this game, does it feel like you have, you know, even more breathing room than you did after DOS 1 to, you know, for whatever you're working on next, kind of take your time?
No. We're doing something big. So we have this strong ambition to improve it with every new game that we make. So we're incredibly critical for ourselves. So when we're looking at DOS 2, the discussions are more about what we did wrong and how we could have improved things than it is about, okay, this was fun. So for the next one, we're putting a lot of pressure on our shoulders. I think it'll be cool. You'll see what happens.
So talking about, you know, players being able to split up, do some quests that other players might not see, what do you think is some of the best, you know, either quest content or jokes or something that's kind of down a path that probably, you know, most players aren't going to take because it requires sort of an unusual set of choices?
Did you try the entire chicken quest when you were in the Driftwood?
Is that the one where it ends up with the void woken chicken? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, but it goes further than that.
I'm not sure if I got all to the way to the end of all it right. then.
So I'm not going to spoil it for you. I didn't know it was in there, right? So
okay.
I really had to laugh very hard when I saw what I did with it. It was really, really funny.
Are there some Easter eggs in there that people haven't found yet?
That they haven't found? That I don't know, because I don't know how people...
What everyone has done.
Yeah. I did find there was one of your colleagues in another magazine who was like saying, what the hell is this? And there was a random board somewhere. And there were two boots next to it.
Oh, I think that was Kirk Hamilton at
exactly.
Kotaku, yeah.
Yeah, so I really laughed with that. I mean, like, because that was a snowboard, right? Mm. And it was put there as a reference for a friend of one of the designers. So that, I thought that was really nice, because I didn't know also, and so I was like, because it looked like to me like somebody left some junk behind. So there's some level...
There was a purpose there, yeah.
Yeah.
There was meaning.
There was meaning behind it, so it was pretty cool, yeah.
During the development of Divinity Original Sin 2, you know, do you have time to play other games? I kind of picture you working and sleeping occasionally and that kind of being all you're doing.
This is one of my biggest problems in life, is the time to game. I'll be completely honest, since the Switch came, my life is a lot better in that sense, because when I'm traveling, I can take that one in my hands. So, because I really needed a good device to be able to play on the road. But it's not that I don't play. Like, I'm a good game I'm playing now, which you're talking about later, is Into the Breach.
It's a great game.
It's a really, really good game. It's really cleverly made. I mean, it's almost like an RPG also, you know? Like, you start with a small party that does this thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I really enjoyed it. But not as much as I would like to, yeah.
What have you, seen in the last couple years that you think will, you know, directly or indirectly influence your work as a designer?
Well, I have to say that there's a lot of production values that I've been looking at. So we are in the state of the art is moving fast, incredibly fast, especially with the new tools that we're getting. We're getting lots of procedural generation tools that allow our workflows to be completely different. You got photogrammetry, which is where people basically take pictures of 3D models and then the 3D model comes out. So it accelerates a lot of things. So, also been looking a lot at what's happening at the AI front. So, there's a lot of AI you haven't really seen it come, but there's a lot of things being done. And so, once that's going to come to the fore, it's going to have a big impact on the game. To see how something like that impacts DOS 2, you must have noticed the AI was better than in DOS 1.
Definitely.
Yeah,
and we were only playing on, I guess, normal difficulty.
Yeah.
So, I feel like there was probably a lot of smart AI action that I didn't you know, was not at the receiving end of because we didn't play on that really hard difficulty where they really try to fuck you up.
It's handicapped at a normal level. But the but it's an indication of how much of a different gameplay experience you can get if there's an AI that actually is, I'm not going to say clever, but it's reasoning about what's possible. Mm-hmm. So, and I think you're going to see much more of that in the future, definitely on PC.
The worst thing the AI would pull on us was, and it's not bad for them, it was just bad for us, was when they would take over one of your characters, charm them somehow, and then they just start using your best scrolls and potions that you've been saving up, and you're like, no, I needed that rain scroll or that lava scroll or whatever.
But from a developer point of view, that's one of our proudest moments, because when we saw it for the first time, say, oh my God, it's so awesome, look what he's doing, right? Because he was calculating what's the best move that I can make here.
Yep.
Right?
It also made me feel like a little dumb for, you know, hoarding those items, because I think that's something most RPG players do, is they get these one-time use items and consumables, and they just don't use them. You just keep them in your inventory the whole game, and you're like, there'll be a perfect moment for this, and then you never use it.
Yeah.
Your AI used more scrolls probably than I did.
It was very easy for the combat designers. Well, easy. I mean, they worked very really hard, but it was if they gave something to the AI, it would come up with new ways of doing it. It made it hard to script fights also. So because it's nice if a fight has a story, you know, it has a beginning, and there's a twist in the middle, there's something surprising at the end. But in a game where you had so much immersion gameplay, systemic gameplay, I think it was a good move to do it this way. So less scripting, more AI, and I think whatever we do in the future, you'll see us walk that route.
Does the AI still surprise you when you go back in Urgils into and mess around?
Not anymore. It did definitely at the beginning, all of us. In the beginning, it tended to do a lot of crowd control in your party, tended to swamp a singular character because that was the optimal strategy. So
right.
We had to teach it not to do that anymore because it wasn't fun, you know, if it would be you. And the AI says, well, I'll just kill you and then I'll kill you and I'll immobilize you. But we saw clever things coming out from it. And it was cool to see them fight against each other also, what they came up with.
On the higher difficulties, are they more brutal about, you know, targeting a single character, going after them, exploiting a weakness?
No, we crippled that completely because it was too dominant a strategy for the AI. Mm-hmm. Because typically in these fights, it's one against many. Mm-hmm. So you're under, they're not even the fights, right? The AI actually has the advantage, technically speaking, and you then have to figure out a way, because I'm cleverer, of dealing with it, definitely in the later stages of combat. So there were a couple of things that we didn't activate because they're just not fun. Right? Mm. I mean, the programmers could have gone much further also, but it was sufficient of a challenge. When you gave the AI teleportation abilities, then it really started becoming miserable for players, you know?
Yeah, there were some enemies when they had high mobility in some of the later matches. It was like, that got pretty brutal.
Yeah, or when they started swapping around surfaces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that made it, you know, even more satisfying to take them down. And I think
that's the thing, right?
It also would promote you to think about strategies that you wouldn't normally do.
This is one of the things that was really neat to see, players being educated about the AI and the things that it could do. It was almost like a tutorial that was being given by the AI. So that was very nice to see how that evolved. It was also some, because we had long discussions whether or not we were going to do the AI this way, right? So it almost didn't happen. So it was we had a couple of guys, and luckily that were very stubborn about it, and so they prevailed. And it was good.
When my friends and I went up against a drama leak the first time, he just wrecked us, and we were like, how can we have, you know, he's got so much health and armor, how can we take him down quickly enough that Losa can survive the encounter and everything? And the first time just did not go well. We also tried to use Death Fog on him, which doesn't work. Are demons technically undead, or was that just he was too big of a badass to not get killed by Death Fog?
Death Fog has a demonic aspect to it.
So
that's why you have a problem. Because when you go to the Blood Island, that's where there's plenty of demons over there also.
Right, so we just killed ourselves with the Death Fog the first time. And then we went back and we figured out that if we used the combination of like crit and strength potions along with the necromancer abilities to live on the edge so you can't be killed when you're at one hit, one health and then get bonus damage from how low your health is. Right. And I pretty much like two-shot him with a longsword.
Yeah, so there's a couple of interesting design aspects to that. So the first one is that this is what we want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's really cool. That's it's a cool strategy. The second one is that that you could two-shot him. That's it's a very big problem in RPGs when you get to the later level of a game. So because we don't know which choices you're going to make. So there's so many branches possible, even at the balancing front also, that when you come to the end of the game, that's something that can happen. So, but well done. I mean, it brings. I just reminded me because you asked me in the beginning, and I didn't really come up with really good examples for you of ways that people handled the game. I think one of my favorite stories was actually from a reviewer who, at the ending of the game, if you are free of sin, you can just go through one of the final gates.
No shit.
Yeah, seriously. So if you did not kill, if you did not steal, and if you did not use any curses, you could just walk through.
Wow.
And so what did he do? He went to the Lady Vengeance, which is your ship. He recruited a henchman who was free of sin. And he went with he had that guy open the door. And then everybody else walked through.
That's brilliant.
It was really clever. I mean, nobody had ever thought of it. I mean, but it again shows how the designers take the systemics really to heart. You know, like it has to be correct according to the rules. And if you abuse the rules, awesome.
I probably cheesed the ending a little bit. Spoilers for anybody who hasn't finished the game, but the kind of your final boss is Brockus, mm-hmm. Brockus Rex. And once you hurt him enough in this kind of initial stage of the encounter, then he kind of reveals himself and goes on to the final big fight.
Yeah.
And the first time we did that, we ran into a bug, so we had to redo the fight.
Yeah.
But the second time, I hit him with Onslaught, which is this ability where you hit like five times, and it triggered his dialogue on like the first hit. And then there was this momentary pause, and then the other hits came out and just annihilated him before we could trigger the final fight. And so we just won the game. We got to skip it, which kind of felt great. We were like, all right, yeah, we just owned this guy so hard that we don't even have to deal with the rest of his shit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so you get those kind of things. I mean, because the systems will say, okay, well, when he's dead, we just proceed to the next thing.
Yeah, and it worked. It didn't break the game, so.
No, that's the cool part, and that's... it's one of the basic promises of the game. You can kill anybody and just progress through the game. There will always be a way of finding a way to go to the next step. And that's also the reason why when you get bugs like that the game just corrects itself, essentially.
Keeps working. On kind of a different subject, when the first Original Sin came out, I think it was after the game came out, you wrote a blog post about the number of women who played the game, or you're kind of trying to figure it out, because based on what gender information you could get from the Kickstarter page, I think it was really skewed towards men.
It was on Facebook, it was on Kickstarter, so all the channels pointed to less than 10%, which surprised me, because when I went to PAX, so we would go to pretty much every PAX where, and we see our community, there were many more women that played the game, so it did not correlate for me.
Yeah, so I'm curious if for the second game, if you noticed anything different, or if kind of having that in the back of your head while developing it, you know, changed anything, you know, changed your approach to making the game.
No, we're very genderless in what we try to have a balance. So I think you'll find I'm not going to say it's 50-50, might be 49, 51, something like that. So, we don't really care, you know. It really depends if it makes sense or not. We might make somebody male or might make somebody female, but for the rest, we don't really look at it. So in terms of design or in terms of target audience affecting how the design is being done, it really has no impact. If you want to play as a girl, you can play as a girl. If you want to play as a guy, you can play as a guy. If you want to date a girl and you're a lizard, fine. If you want to date a guy and if you're a dwarf, fine. It's all up to you, right? It's your role-playing experience, right? And so obviously it's different when you have an origin story, because an origin story, that's a character that has a history, and so then that's that character, and so we fix it. But other than that, it's the idea of role-playing is essentially that. You create a character. It's your character, so do what you want. But I still don't know. I still don't know, actually, how the audience is, what the makeup is of it. So there's no really good way of tracking it. When we do surveys at PAX, we see 70-30. a difference. So
it's a lot different than 5%.
Yeah, but it might be because it's at PAX, right? So PAX is a cool crowd. I don't know if you go to a different show, maybe you might have different numbers. So I have absolutely no idea what the balance is. But I was surprised because when I saw it, it just didn't correlate for me.
Gotcha. Yeah. So in GDC here, there's been a lot of talk this year about unionization and a lot of talk about crunch, which I think was sort of like a dirty topic that nobody really wanted to touch for mm-hmm. a while and has gotten talked about a lot more. Can you tell me, like, did you guys have to crunch on Original Sin 2 and sort of what your outlook is on, you know,
so
working long hours
to make a game?
I can talk
all about that. So yes, we crunched, and once we launched, I actually went to all the studios and I went to talk to everybody to try to figure out what did we do wrong, why did we have to crunch? Because mm-hmm. there's two types of crunch. There's the crunch that you do to because you're not ready, yeah? And then there's the crunch that you do because you want to make it brilliant, right? So everybody in general wants to do that second type of crunch. Yeah? The thing, because you're not ready, that's not so cool, right? So we've been looking at, like, what did we do wrong? Why did we have stuff that was not ready? Because there was room, there were sufficient people doing it, but, you know, these are really complex projects, so things go wrong. We're doing very complicated things. So that's the type of crunch that you can do something about. But I don't think you can say, I'm never going to crunch when I'm making a piece of entertainment. I think that a writer that writes a book is going to spend whatever he can when he's writing his book, right? So, and the same thing goes for games. But with games, you have much more people working on the same thing. So, and the nature of our industry is such that there is no penalty for crunch from the consumer, right? So on the contrary, there's a reward from the consumer for crunch because the games are better, right? So there's been a lot of controversy by several studios who had really a lot of crunch. But then when you look at the games, they're some of the highest acclaimed games. So essentially what people are saying, well, this is what we want. Right?
I mean, it's not always the case, right? Like, there must be situations where the crunch leads to, you know, people burning out and the game actually not turning out better, or, you know, even not talking about the fact that it could have just wrecked their life. You know, there's also
I think we have
got to be cases where it's not
great. You have
to
be careful also in your definitions of crunch, right? So because it now has this incredibly negative connotation, and that's because you're talking about those very prolonged periods of crunch. So mm-hmm. If you have stories that people have been crunching for a year, that's insane, right? So, but that, I don't think most studios do that, and most people are ready to do that. What I'm talking about is the crunch where you say, like, okay, well, this is here, and we're going to finish it. You know, I mean, at Larian, we had a couple of guys that worked some of the weekends, but in general, in the weekends, the place is empty, right? And so we do a couple of overtime, but it's not as if... I mean, we did have guys that crunched, and that was because they were adding content on top, even at the end. So you could say stop to that, yeah? But, I mean, that's... afterwards, people take a break, and so if you balance it well enough, it's okay. So I think the biggest problem is when it's really due to the fact that there's so much stuff that is not okay on your project planning or in management of your project, and that you're trying to compensate it with crunch. It's a different story.
So you mentioned you went to kind of the different, you know, offices and talked about, you know, what did we do wrong? What could we do better? What were some of the learnings you took from that, you know, you'll kind of try to institute in your next project?
So there's a lot about processes, right? So one of the most surprising ones that came out of it, but that pretty much everybody was our documentation was not sufficient. So we had this very big development environment. And so there were people that weren't aware of certain things, so that information was lost. Or, for instance, testers that didn't know how a quest was supposed to go because the quest wasn't updated correctly in documentation. So we made that one. That was one of the biggest lessons that we learned. Then stability of the tools. So when tools are crashing, like we had a combat designer, sometimes he could only make one combat a day because the tool was unstable. So that leads to a cascade of things because you have a waterfall model going on. So one thing goes wrong here and it might lead to something at the other side of the world going wrong there. Or a guy wakes up because we have a studios and from Russia to Canada, so we go with the sun as we develop. But it also means that if I go to sleep and I check something in that breaks the game, and the other guy wakes up and he picks it up and it's broken for him, his day is over, right?
So, right, yeah.
And so those kind of things are things you can fight again. They're not, they can't be, you know, I guess anybody that's ever built a house knows how fast things go wrong, mm-hmm. right? So because you get the same cascade, and that's just a house. It has a lot less moving pieces than a computer game when making it. So there's millions of moving pieces going on. So, and these pieces have to connect somehow. And so when that goes wrong, you have to do something. You can delay your game. But sometimes you can't just keep on doing that delaying. Sometimes you say, okay, this is a deadline, right? So and we're going to work towards that deadline. And then it's up to the team if they are willing to do it. I mean, nobody has ever been forced to crunch at Larian. So the and you hear stories about where it's being you're forced. I'm trying to figure out if I ever said so, but I don't think so. So, but we did work hard. Yeah.
Awesome. Just kind of for fun, one question we've been asking everybody we talk to is to talk to one of the big trends this year in computers and PC gaming, adjacent to PC gaming, which is, can you explain the blockchain in one sentence? I know this is you're an expert on this subject, so come on, lay it on me.
All right. I'm still trying to understand it myself. So I'm trying to like.
I'm
not clever enough, and I can't do that.
That's okay. I can't either, so yeah. It's fine. It's fine.
If ever somebody does, please let me know because I really would like to know.
We've gotten a couple explanations that I think are mostly right, but also have ended with something like, "and it'll be irrelevant in a few years." So
yeah, that's true.
If you wait long enough, maybe you won't have to find out.
Oh, well, I have an idea. I have one for
okay,
you.
Okay,
it's a digital technology that makes something scarce, and because it's scarce, it allows people to make money with it.
All right. Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah, I think the money-making part seems the key. That's what most people are in it for. I think.
Economy is about how to manage scarce resources, right?
Awesome. Yeah. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything you're excited about coming this year? You know, other games, other people's games you're looking forward to playing?
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to Cyberpunk. So I hope that we're going to see something at E3.
Me too.
Yeah, so I would imagine so. I'm curious to see what Bethesda has cooking. So if there's going to be an Elder Scrolls, yes or no. So I'm very curious about that. What else? I keep on hearing these things about the secret project of Obsidian, so I'd like to see that one. So Deadfire is coming out, so I'm very curious about playing Deadfire. The alpha of Bard's Tale just launched, so I want to try it out.
I've played it. It's really fun.
Yeah, well, yeah. It looks like fun. I looked at the video this morning. It looked really good, actually.
The combat's really cool. A lot of tactical kind of combinations going on there, even with a small party. So.
I'm very happy about that. Yeah. I have an NPC in that game. I kickstarted it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
So you should encounter me, hopefully.
Does he look like you?
Apparently, because I took a picture of me and sent it over to the team at an exile. So I'm very curious to see what's going to come out of that. And there's another game. It's Kingmaker, Pathfinder. So that's coming out this summer, I think. So I'm really looking forward to that. They have some, from what I've seen in their Kickstarter updates, it looked like they're doing something cool.
It's going to be a good year for RPGs, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's the resurgence, right? And then that's to be honest, that is thanks to guys like Steam and GOG that is possible. Otherwise, it would just not happen. And Kickstarter also.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for joining me, Sven. We're gonna get going back to the conference, back to GDC. Got other stuff to do.
Thank you.
And we'll have more podcasts this week coming from people at GDC talking about cool games.
All right. Thanks, Wes.